Welcome back for the third and final hour of Issues Etc. today. We're going to be talking with Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of church history at St. Louis University. Two stories. We'll deal with the one about the hit-and-run bishop first, and we'll also be talking in the broader scope of the sexual scandal in the Roman Catholic Church, in particular the very recent resignation of Governor Keating as the head of an oversight committee looking into how the bishops handled sexual abuse among the priests. Those are the two topics with Dr. James Hitchcock. In the second part of this hour, we'll spend 25 minutes talking with Amy White. She's author of a column, and perhaps you saw it, in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, titled, "With Hillary Rodham Clinton, Everything's Relative." We'll get her review of the former First Lady's new book. That's in the second part of this hour. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. James Hitchcock, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Here.
Dr. Hitchcock, let's start with the story of Bishop O'Brien in Phoenix. It's more than just a hit-and-run story. Give us kind of the brief history of what's happened with this Phoenix bishop.
It was revealed some weeks ago that he had signed an agreement with the prosecutors in Phoenix in which he had surrendered a certain amount of the oversight of clerical behavior because he was vulnerable to criminal prosecution for having known about pedophile priests and having not done anything about it. So he was already, you say, in trouble with the law. Then earlier this week, he hit and killed a man and drove away from the scene under circumstances which are still not fully clear as far as I know, and he has now resigned.
And the Vatican has accepted his resignation?
Yeah, that's correct. They had supposedly earlier refused to accept his resignation. I think this has really been an unfortunate pattern in the Vatican in recent years, and that is sticking with bishops who have done dubious things too long. And many Catholics will point out other things. This is the most egregious thing that has come up, but there have been other things that are some Catholics think are improper. I hope this will cause the Vatican to rethink to some extent the tendency to just support a bishop no matter what happens.
What does this case, I mean, this is obviously an extreme case. Number one, a bishop ceding much of his authority to the state to oversee sexual abuse cases in his own diocese. That's unprecedented. But then in the twist of fate or coincidence or whatever it may be, to then be arrested for a crime like this, the unrelated to it, what does this say about the moral authority of this bishop as it was? And of the Conference of Bishops in general?
Well, I would say, so far as this bishop is concerned, his moral authority is now about zero, and it's unfortunate that he hadn't resigned earlier. And it's true, unfortunately, when things like this happen, it tends to taint everybody, even those who are devoted. I don't in any way excuse this, but it is, of course, basic Christian doctrine, we have all sinned. And I think it is particularly Lutheran doctrine, we are not saved by fulfilling the law. If we had to be all morally perfect before we could preach about morality, we would never preach about morality at all. Our pulpits would be empty because we could find no one who was qualified to preach. So on the one hand, I think what's happened here is egregious. The bishop should have resigned a long time ago. On the other hand, I don't think you can say, well, therefore, bishops shouldn't speak out on moral questions.
Now, Bishop Wilton Gregory of Belleville, who's also the presiding, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops that are meeting this week, has said that no matter what the other bishops do, they will really always be judged by their weakest member. Do you agree with him?
I think in the popular mind that is probably true. I would also say this. I don't myself think that the bishops in general have taken the strong leadership position which they ought to take. Bishop O'Brien is a case of his own, and no one else is in that same category as far as I know. But You know, here we can connect some dots. Bishop O'Brien was the chairman of a committee of the Catholic bishops some years back that issued an official statement on the subject of homosexuality. Not all the bishops agreed with it, but he was allowed to do it. And it comes about as close as the Catholic Church is likely to come in saying that homosexual behavior is okay. Doesn't quite say that, but emphasizes instead being accepting and so on. This is a man who never should have been entrusted with any kind of responsibility by his fellow bishops, and yet they did.
As the Conference of Catholic Bishops meets together this week, they are doing it under the cloud of a recent resignation on the part of Governor Keating, who had been in charge of the task force overseeing their activities as they deal with the priestly sexual abuse scandal. Why did Keating resign? What was his reason?
Well, the immediate cause of it was he said publicly that some of the bishops were like the Cosa Nostra or the Mafia in terms of suppressing evidence, refusing to cooperate with the law. He was particularly referring to Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles. Cardinal Mahoney then blasted back and said Keating was unqualified to serve on the committee, criticized Bishop Gregory, which is a very, very unusual thing, for having appointed Keating. And then apparently the majority of the board thought that, yes, the time had come for Keating to resign. My own feeling on this is the rhetoric was very unfortunate, and possibly because of that he had to resign. On the other hand, I do think he raised some substantial questions. It's very obvious that Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles is not cooperating with the law as he should. So I think it still is an open question, where is this going to go from here?
I'd like to read a quote from the letter that Governor Frank Keating wrote to Bishop Gregory at his resignation. He's fairly adamant. He refuses to apologize for the La Cosa Nostra comment, likening the bishops to a criminal organization. In fact, he says this: "As I have recently said, and I have repeated in the last several occasions, our church is a faith institution, a home to Christ's people. It's not a criminal enterprise. It does not condone or cover up criminal activity. It does not follow a code of silence. My remarks, which some bishops found offensive, were deadly accurate. I make no apology. To resist grand jury subpoenas, to suppress the names of offending clerics, to deny, to obfuscate, to explain away, that is the model of a criminal organization, not my church." How do you respond to Keating's? Well, he's continuing to say this, they're acting like a criminal organization.
Right. Well, as I say, I think his rhetoric is unfortunate, and of course it's going to provoke angry reactions and is probably going to be counterproductive, which is what some of the people on the committee said. On the other hand, I think there is some proof to what he's saying. We have a perfect example in Bishop O'Brien. It is now publicly recognized that he did behave in a criminal manner more than once. And there's no question that although many, perhaps most of the bishops of the United States are cooperating with this committee, there are certainly some who are publicly refusing to do so. The bishops are very, you know, legitimately concerned about the independence of the church, about the confidentiality of information. But unfortunately, the historical record, as it's come out in the last couple of years, is that most bishops have not been willing to deal with this problem. And if that's the case, then the problem's going to be dealt with by somebody else.
Do you believe that the bishops, and I know I'm asking you to generalize here, but do you believe that the reticence on the part of the bishops to deal forthrightly and completely above board on the issue of priestly sexual abuse has to do with the fact that they are afraid that their negligence in the past will come to light?
There is certainly some of that involved, absolutely. Then the question, of course, is why were they negligent to begin with? And then that's a $64,000 question that I don't know that we've ever come up with an adequate answer. But there is an elephant in the living room here that is not much talked about, because in a sense, people on all sides of the question have reasons not to talk about it, and that's what I've already referred to, and that is the phenomenon of homosexuality. Most of these offenses are by homosexually inclined priests. you have liberals who are ordinarily highly critical of the hierarchy and say freedom, freedom, lay rights, etc. But they're also pro-homosexual, most of these liberals. And then there do exist some homosexual clergy. You could call it a kind of a network. No one knows exactly how large it is or how many of them there are. This is a major reason, I think, why this problem is not being dealt with in a forthright manner. And even those who are most critical of the bishops on this will stop short in most cases of saying, look, homosexual clergy are the root of all of this.
Who will take Governor Keating's place? Is there any clear indication, and how would that decision be made?
Well, the vice chairman, who's a lady named Ann Burke from Chicago, I don't know anything about her, has temporarily taken over. I would guess that Bishop Gregory has the authority to appoint a chairman, as he did the first time around. In view of the strong criticism that was made of him by Cardinal Mahoney, I suspect Bishop Gregory would consult at least fairly widely before choosing a successor. It would make sense probably to pick a successor from within the committee itself. Now, whether that would be Ms. Burke or someone else, I don't know.
Many viewed Keating as kind of the two-edged sword. Keating was the fiercely devout Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
He was also fiercely independent-minded with regard to the church, which
right.
I think is a quality shared by a great many Catholics,
right.
Parishioners in the church as well. But he's also viewed in a lot of ways as a maverick, not a maverick with regard to Catholic doctrine, but with regard to seeing things done, getting things done. Is something going to be lost if there isn't that kind of aggressive approach to the bishop's behavior from this committee?
Well, I wish that Keating had followed Theodore Roosevelt's claim of speaking softly and carrying a big stick. I think that rhetorical displays like his usually don't do much good. He could be as aggressive as he wanted to be, and all the better. Inflammatory rhetoric probably doesn't help anything. But I think we have to assume that since that he was a very aggressive man, and therefore some degree of aggressiveness has been lost. Now, some of the other people on the committee are saying we're not backing off in the least. We're plunging ahead. I've been a little disappointed because it seemed to me that in the last year we haven't seen anything very concrete emerge from that committee. If we don't begin to see something concrete emerge fairly soon, then I think it will be somewhat tempting to think that Governor Keating was correct.
Are we likely, given time, and this will take time, of course, I think everyone agrees on that, are we likely to see yet more shocking revelations of the type found by the with the Bishop of Phoenix, where this bishop was willing, in order to keep his position and escape indictment, he was willing to cede a good measure of his authority to the state?
It may well happen in other cases. I keep coming back to Cardinal Mahoney, possibly the single most prominent member of the hierarchy right now, having a long-running battle now with prosecutors in California going back a year or more, refusing to turn over evidence, fighting it in the courts, et cetera, et cetera. And there are indications that have leaked out that there are things that he's covering up, no question about it. The scandal in Boston, where it started, forced the resignation of Cardinal Bernard Law. Indications that I've seen are that the scandals in Los Angeles may be just as great. And if that's probably the direction in which to look, to see if the prosecutors, how the prosecutors are going to pursue it.
Was it truly unprecedented for the Bishop of Phoenix to say, look, I remain bishop, but when it comes to the oversight of any of these investigations of these cases, I cede all my authority to basically the district attorney?
As far as I know, nothing like that has ever happened. It's a very bad thing for the church. What should have been done was to appoint a bishop who could be relied upon to do the right thing and to do a good job. it's an arrangement which saved Bishop O'Brien's job, if you will, but it did great harm to the church in many different ways. And I think it's extremely short-sighted of the Vatican not to see that we can't tolerate bishops like this. You know, this is where things are going to end up, with the church losing some of its independence. There's no quicker way to bring that about than to continue in office men like Bishop O'Brien.
Dr. James Hitchcock is our guest. He's professor of church history at St. Louis University. We're talking about this week's meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Given the fact that there's widespread perception of a code of silence, to what degree or another, criminal or not, what has the Pope done to encourage full disclosure on the part of American bishops on this issue? Has he done anything to speak of?
Not to my knowledge. He has spoken on the subject and said how deeply shocked and grieved he is over the morality of the practice. The thing about John Paul II, which has been noticed often by many Catholics, is he is not a disciplinarian. He is portrayed by his liberal critics as being reactionary, authoritarian. That's because he affirms controversial church teachings, and he does it very strongly. But he's very, very reluctant to use his disciplinary powers. This has been discussed among conservative Catholics for years. You know, how can he tolerate Bishop so-and-so? How can he tolerate this particular theologian, et cetera, et cetera? For whatever reason, and there are all kinds of theories about it, he's not a disciplinarian, and he has not shown himself to be one in this case.
In addition to that, there's kind of a well-established tendency on the part of the Vatican to resist on a matter of principle outside pressure of any kind to move in one direction or another. They simply keep their own counsel and their own timetable, right?
That's correct. I mean, I think in principle that's a good thing for any church to do. You know, we're supposed to be marching to God's drummer, not to that of society. But you have to make sure you are marching to God's drummer. And in a case of this kind, where it seems to me the policy formulated inside the church itself has been just tragically wrong, then it's going to lead to disastrous results, which it has done. I mean, there were known problems with bishops. We didn't know the extent of it, but there were problems of various kinds related to sexual conduct of priests and so on, going back years. And Catholics were often saying, why doesn't Rome do something? Why doesn't Rome do something? And for whatever reason, the Vatican, as I say, under John Paul II, has not been inclined to exercise a good deal of discipline.
What do you expect to emerge from this week's meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops?
Well, we won't really know for sure, because the most crucial parts of it having to deal with this issue will be closed behind closed doors with no media coverage. There is clearly a rift that has developed in this, is a very extraordinary instance of Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles openly criticizing Bishop Gregory of Belleville, which is something bishops rarely do. It's been a year, as I say, since the committee was set up. It's been a year since these rather, on paper, strict rules were put into effect. Nothing highly visible has happened in the meantime. I believe there are going to be some bishops, Cardinal Mahoney being one, who are going to say, we panicked last year. We gave away too much. We've got to reassert our authority. I doubt that anything dramatically visible is going to emerge, because, again, it's going to be behind closed doors. We will begin to see over the next few months what, if anything, was decided there.
If the bishops decide to do just what you speculate they might, and that is to say, look, we went too far with this whole thing last time. We really had a knee-jerk reaction. Let's reassert our authority. Let's say, fine, we will handle our own affairs, and we will take care of our own houses. How do you think that is likely to play, not only with Roman Catholics in the United States, but with the general culture and its perception of the Roman Catholic hierarchy?
Well, I think it would be quite disastrous if that were to happen, because, again, it's not as though they haven't had numerous opportunities. Unfortunately, I know of a few dioceses where there have been no scandals. that where, as far as we know, there were no pedophile cases. There were a few like that. I don't know of any diocese, however, which had such scandals where it could be said the bishop handled it absolutely with complete responsibility and did the right thing and was courageous and thorough. There's not a single case like that that I'm aware of. So there is this tremendous pall of mistrust, and I think it's a reality.
We are told many times that the priestly scandal in the Roman Catholic Church is really a very few bad apples among the priests that are tainting the whole bunch, and I tend to believe that. I think, on the whole, Catholic priests are rather faithful men. Can the same be said of the bishops in the United States, that it's just a few bad apples?
Well, as far as those that are actively guilty of misconduct, like Bishop O'Brien, yes, that's true. There's the old saying, you often hear it quoted, nothing allows evil to flourish as good men do nothing. And that is, I think, where the real problem was. What I find myself personally shocking, most shocking, is not that there were pedophile priests and even some misbehaving bishops, because human nature is as it is and there will always be some bad apples. What shocks me is the failure of so many bishops to be shocked. This is what comes out in Boston, where, for example, you had a priest who not only was a pedophile going around the country making speeches advocating pedophilia, and Cardinal Law of Boston apparently could see nothing wrong with this. That's been what has been most shocking, and it remains deeply mysterious as to why there has been such toleration of this, even though, as you say, it's a small number. The very fact that it's a small number ought to mean that we are very shocked and we will take strong measures, and yet somehow, resident, we don't.
Dr. Hitchcock, we have less than a minute here before we have to go. How would you characterize your confidence in Bishop Wilton Gregory to lead the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in the right direction from this point on?
My impression of Bishop Gregory is that he is a sort of a consensus person, if you will. There's a tendency to elect as president of the conference a man who gets along with everyone, who's not strongly identified with one faction or other, who probably thinks that his job is to bring everybody together and arrive at consensus. So my inclination is to think Bishop Gregory is not going to try to move the conference in one direction or another, but he's going to try to sound out other bishops. So the result is likely to be, again, somewhat inconclusive.
I wouldn't want his job in any event. Dr. James Hitchcock, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of church history at St. Louis University. We've been talking about this week's meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and we'll continue to watch the headlines in that regard. Amy White is with us after the break. She wrote a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Maybe you saw it. With Hillary Rodham Clinton, everything is relative. In her new book, Amy writes, Hillary gives herself plenty of credit but takes very little responsibility. We'll get her review of the former First Lady's book that's just out right after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence, because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues Etc.
Abortion, what's its connection to evolution?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the hard-hitting book, Genesis and the Decay of the Nations. Well, Ken, why do Christians seem to have lost the abortion battle?
It's sad that so many Christians are unaware that they're fighting abortion in the wrong way. They don't recognize that abortion is really a symptom of a far greater problem. You see, what's happening in society is this. Years ago, people generally believed that God was creator, and therefore God set the rules. Thus, abortion was wrong, based upon what the Bible said. But that foundation in society has been slowly eroded and replaced with another one, evolution. Now, this foundation teaches people that they're just animals in the struggle for survival as life has evolved over millions of years. Therefore, what develops in the womb is only an animal. And when you think about it, the more children are taught that they're just animals, then they'll think that what develops in a mother's womb is just an animal also. So if you want to get rid of a stray cat, you can also get rid of a spare kid. After all, they're all just animals. The increasing rate of abortion has gone hand in hand with the increasing popularity of evolution. So if you want to fight the abortion issue, you've got to convince people to believe in the Creator and trust His Word.
And if you want to fight racism, Genesis has the answer too. Read Ken Ham's free booklet, Where Did the Racists Come From? Log on to our website, AnswersRadio.com. It's a free service of AnswersRadio.com.
At 5:31 a.m. 850 KF, your weather for St. Louis. So mostly clear tonight. You may need a jacket as you head out. Low of 52 expected. Tomorrow it will be sunny with a high of 80. Mostly cloudy and 78 at 5:31. In traffic, westbound 40 is jammed from Van Vitter to an accident west of the Science Center, which is blocking the two left lanes. And then it's just heavy from 270 to Mason and Long Road to Highway K. Southbound 270 is jammed from Highway 40 to a stalled vehicle north of Doherty Ferry, blocking the right lane. And eastbound 40 is slow between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge. Also eastbound 270 stop and go between McDonald and 170. Next, Todd Wilkin talks to Amy White about Hillary Rodham Clinton's new book, as Issues Etc. continues.
Sign on at 6:30 Friday morning. Wake up with inspiration, information. Yours truly, Paul Clayton, and my trusty sidekick, our chief meteorologist, Larry Carter. We'll have a good time. Marty Linthet joins us from Concordia Seminary, where she's a counselor. We'll also hear commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer and a devotional from Pastor Todd Wilkin. Plus, we'll give you the answer to the AM 850 KFUO Daily Bible Quiz on the Friday morning show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll have a two-hour discussion on the doctrine of the Trinity, a lively discussion at that, with Dr. Ken Sherb of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. During the last 30 minutes of the program, we're going to spend a little time reviewing and previewing the new book by Hillary Rodham Clinton. Amy White is our guest. She is a corporate and political speechwriter and author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled, With Hillary Rodham Clinton, Everything is Relative. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Amy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd, very much.
What is the book about?
Well, I think the book is about Hillary Rodham Clinton's life thus far as she sees it. And that is what is most telling, that throughout this is her perception of her personal life, her career, her life as First Lady, and now her life as New York Senator.
Now, one can hardly quibble with the title of the book, because there is no doubt about it. Hillary Rodham Clinton and those surrounding her are personages of history. I mean, you don't get to be First Lady of the United States without at least being able to make a claim on history to that degree. How does she perceive history, or at least her part in it?
I think that the emphasis that Hillary has throughout the book is that the history that she's living and the history of the past is something that has to be changed. in order to be redeemed. And that really stood out to me in the book. There is very little space given to speaking of America's heritage or the proud leadership that America has shown in our short history. There's always a focus on what's lacking and how progressive democratic politics will be the solution. And she also speaks of a lot of different things that came up during her husband's elections and his terms in office in terms of Republicans trying to set back the clock on the progress that had been made on behalf of the American people. So it's a very slanted, very biased, very political viewpoint of history.
You characterize the general viewpoint of the former First Lady's book, Living History, by calling upon the term moral relativism. What do you mean by that, and how does that apply to the former First Lady's book?
Well, what I mean by that is that Hillary Clinton seems to interpret everything through the grid of whether or not she believes she is a good person or a bad person. She believes herself to be a good person, and thereby what she attempts to do, what she achieves, the policy directives she works for are uniformly good. Those who stand against them are uniformly bad. And when I speak of moral relativism, what struck me as I plowed my way through this 600-page book is that everything is relative to her own personal goodness. The person who criticizes her is bad because she's a good person. The person who would run against her husband is only up to dirty tricks. Everything is interpreted through the grid of her own experience, her own belief of right and wrong, and it seems that she believes herself to be almost exclusively right.
It's impossible to answer this question with any certitude, but do you believe that former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is portraying history and her place in it as she really sees it, or is the more cynical take might be she is simply trying to rewrite history as she wants people to see it?
I think it's possible, Todd, that both those realities are true. In terms of, I think sometimes we all engage in a little wishful thinking. But there is a very systematic attempt throughout the book, I think, to go back and correct what is perceived by many Americans as a lack within the Clinton administration. There's even several mentions throughout the book of Bill Clinton, quote, sounding the trumpet call, the alarm on worldwide terrorism. Now, I don't know what your recollection is of the Clinton administration, but I do not remember them speaking of all these initiatives that were necessary to guard ourselves against international terrorism. But there must be over a dozen references to the book of how, in the book, of how Bill Clinton was the one who saw the threat long ago, who urged Congress to help him, but they refused. And it was just very shocking to me that she was clearly interested in trying to restate who had first seen the threat.
In other respects, how does the former president come off in the book?
Oh, goodness. Well, there's a lot of emphasis on the former president having lovely hands and looking like a Viking and being a great dad and being easy to laugh with and all kinds of very positive, warm reflections. And she seems to feel that his politics are really the only hope that the majority of the people who live in the United States have. And it really comes across that Bill Clinton is potentially a savior and that the current administration is rolling back the clock on everything that he did.
So she loves her husband's policies and ideas, yet she certainly must deal with the fact of history that he was found guilty of infidelity toward her in a rather gross way during his tenure as president. How does she deal with that subject?
That is dealt with in a very odd way because there's absolutely no reference to any kind of tension or infidelity or crisis in the marriage until she is discussing his presidential run and the fact that they had to go on 60 Minutes to acknowledge that he had caused pain, I believe was the famous phrase, in their marriage. So until that point, there is not even a whisper of innuendo. that there is anything occurring. And then suddenly you find this reference to them preparing for the 60 Minutes interview to put to rest the incredible scrutiny that had developed over Bill's private life, how ridiculous and inappropriate it was, and that this was what was necessary to deal with it.
So the infidelities that are not only speculated about, of course, which are not verifiable, but those which are even admitted to by the President Clinton when he was running for president during his time as governor of Arkansas, are they dealt with at all in this book?
Not in the least. Not in the least, which is why we would have to call into question the true biographical element of this piece. Because as you read it, it is clearly designed to paint Hillary as an ideal woman, Bill as a flawed but noble man, and the two of them together dedicating their entire life for the purposes of the citizens of America and the citizens of the world.
How does the former First Lady's book deal with the issue of the perjury, which was established in fact, and the impeachment?
You know, there's a very strange reference to the perjury because it's fairly fleeting that Bill was convinced he had not perjured himself because the questions he had been asked were so clumsy. That's a direct quote. That the president was sure that he was not guilty because his response to the questions was the best he could do because the questions were so clumsy. I mean, that's really not the most sophisticated excuse I've ever heard. Quite frankly, they have allies who have offered better rationales for getting out of the perjury situation. But she emphasizes again and again her own experience preparing the case against Richard Nixon in his impeachment, and that because of that experience, she knew absolutely that he had done nothing that would be considered a high crime and misdemeanor.
Now, I don't know. I consider myself as cynical as the next person. And I have believed for many years, all through the double term of Bill Clinton, that if you could take Hillary Rodham Clinton apart in a room by herself, where no cameras would record, no reporters would be writing anything down, and ask her about these issues, that she would probably be quite honest, and she would express her frustration, her anger. She would express, even admit to, you know, not only her husband's failings, but also to her own. Does it surprise you? And it surprises me that this book is so, at least according to your review of it, so very one-sided in her saintly behavior and everyone else's wicked intentions. Does that surprise you?
Well, it does surprise me, unless you take into account that I think Hillary Clinton is a very politically ambitious woman and has been from a very young age, which is certainly no crime. But she is clearly prepared to state for the record a certain version of events, and I think she anticipates running on that version of events.
Do you think readers are going to buy it?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I know I don't. Because working my way through this book, I decided that I would highlight things that really stuck out to me. And pretty soon I was just highlighting these massive paragraphs. And then I switched to paper clips. And then I switched to colored markers. I mean, there was just so much reference to trying to establish a, quite frankly, an unhuman-like character on behalf of her and her husband. And there was such an attempt to sort of plug in potential holes in the Clinton legacy, everything from the status of their marriage to Bill Clinton's neglect of certain terrorism issues. There's even a segment where Hillary personally appears to take credit for welfare reform, which was the product of the Gingrich Congress that came into power, you know, when Bill had only been in the Oval Office for a few years. There's a segment there where she talks about welfare reform, and just in the span of six sentences, she uses the pronoun I over 10 times. So she is clearly trying to take a hold of certain issues, and I think it's for political purpose.
We're talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton's new book, Living History, with a reviewer, Amy White, who you can read for yourself in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Her column called With Hillary Rodham Clinton, Everything's Relative. She's a corporate and political speechwriter. If you have a question or a comment on this book, maybe you've read it yourself and have a different take, or maybe you're thinking about reading it, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers will get top priority. You can read Amy's column not only in the paper, But it's in the Metro section of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today if you want to pick it up. You can also read it on the Internet at stltoday.com, stltoday.com. Okay, how does she portray her role in the 8 years of the Clinton presidency? There were people who said, is she first lady? Is she co-president? What's going on here? How does she portray her role in the presidency?
She portrays herself as someone who is working constantly to advocate women's rights and children's rights, and she emphasizes that through many, many long chapters, international travels, and speeches that she gives, including at the UN Conference on the Rights of Women in Beijing. So there's a lot of emphasis on that work, and it's clearly something that she takes pride in. For me personally, it's a little artificial to hear someone stress again and again their work on behalf of children and to constantly claim the mantle of an advocate for children when she has no interest in the child in the womb. And strangely enough, she offers no personal rationale or history for how she came to her conclusion on the pro-life abortion issue. It's simply absent. The only time she refers to it is in the context of Mother Teresa of Calcutta sending her repeated notes concerning her pro-choice position and how troubled she was by it. And that is really the only reference you find, and there's no rationale, there's no discussion, and yet it's clearly something that's very important to her, because in the last chapter of the book, when she's discussing running for Senate in New York, she has a TV spot prepared that part of the text reads, on breast cancer and health care and education and a woman's right to choose, Hillary will never walk away. And then she says, in conclusion of this paragraph, that summed up everything I wanted people to think about as they cast their ballots. Now, that indicates to me that the pro-choice issue is central to all of her social and political philosophy, but it is given very short shrift in the book.
Do you think that this book represents yet another step in the former First Lady's presidential aspirations for herself?
I do believe that that is what the book is designed to do. I think it is designed to elevate her to a different level, to help segregate out her accomplishments from those of her husband, to give her a different kind of formal political identity, and to emphasize the way she has been politically active for many long years. And I think she intends on running on that, either running for another New York Senate term or perhaps even setting her sights higher. After reading this book, I'm absolutely convinced that Hillary Clinton is convinced that she would be a fantastic president. I don't know if she will step into that role. I don't know how seriously she wants it, but I have every confidence she believes she is more than capable and more than skilled to be able to lead America even further into the 21st century.
Do you think that she is a person and the way she portrays herself, her ideas resonate with most American women? If so, why? And if not, why not?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that, Todd, because I think that you have a lot of different women right now who are enjoying the fruits of a more liberated society where women have more educational choices, job choices, more choices for their life overall. And there are many women who look at all those choices and still prefer to make fairly traditional choices according to what they believe their faith asks of them and what their own personal instincts and desires are. So I think you see some women who can acknowledge that Hillary has accomplished a great deal, but who can also feel quite a bit of contempt for the policies that she endorses. So I think there's some women who have very mixed feelings about her. And I think there's a very large majority of women who certainly feel sympathetic that she has been humiliated by her husband in such a public way.
What does it say then when most people look at this, men and women, say she's been humiliated by her husband in a public way, and she seems to say, no, I was completely surprised by it all, and I've never been humiliated?
Well, she does acknowledge being embarrassed and furious, and there's, you know, this really weak language about wanting to wring his neck, you know, which I just think is sort of a laughable phrase. It's so tame. I don't know if that was her first draft to describe how she felt in the situation, or if she, you know, considered other phrases, but she chose the phrase, "I wanted to wring his neck." And, you know, it's sort of ironic that even though Hillary technically was embarrassed, and I think we can all acknowledge that, she seems to have put this to excellent use, because she is treated with a completely different, sympathetic air. And I think you can see it even in the interviews, the national media interviews that have taken place with her as a result of the book being released. You have these incredibly deferential conversations about, tell me about your pain. Tell me how much it hurt. How did you ever get over it? So she is really working this angle, quite frankly. She has not assured anyone that it was easy, or I'm used to it, or, you know, keep on trucking. I mean, she's really been very focused on exploiting that pain.
Is the Hillary Rodham Clinton portrayed in this book, and the one that we know via real history, the facts, are either of them a good role model for young American women?
Well, that struck me, Todd, as I read through this description of her childhood, because Hillary was a young woman who organized neighborhood youth to do different fundraising events for the United Way. She was clearly a very organized, talented, ambitious, smart young woman from the very beginning, and she records through her childhood every committee she served on and every special nomination she received from teachers who recognized her potential. And at one point, she even discusses two different teachers as telling one another that they're battling for her mind and soul. And so she clearly was identified as someone who had remarkable skills. And yet you see her in college and in law school. She speaks without any kind of apology or acknowledgement of living with Bill Clinton years before they married. And there is no acknowledgement of any kind of awkwardness or regret that she has over that situation. And there is really, aside from that, no real clear image of herself as a role model, except for the fact that she seems to be, you know, nearly perfect in every way. And I am just struck that just as an author, she would not want to work in more humility just for the sake of appearances. But she succeeds in an almost uniformly picture of herself as ideal.
Self-congratulatory, is that that's a term I've heard bounced around to describe the book?
I would think that self-congratulatory belongs as part of the subtitle of the book. Hillary Rodham Clinton's Self-Congratulatory Experience of History.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Ann is calling from Crestwood. Ann, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, good afternoon. A couple of years ago, there was an article in Parade magazine about Hillary and her early life, and it spoke so much of her father as never having acknowledged anything she'd done and not attending her graduations and things like that. And I wondered if the book made any mention of that. Thank you.
Good question. Thank you very much, Anne. Amy?
Actually, she speaks very fondly of her father in the book. She emphasizes the fact that he was conservative and Republican, and that he was very supportive of her in all situations. And there was a story she relates that he attended a graduation that her mother could not because of a recent surgery. But nothing emerges about a conflicted relationship besides sort of collegiate and law school year debates over politics, but what emerges is a very warm picture of their relationship. So I'm not familiar with the interview in Parade, but it would be interesting to compare those and to see if there's, you know, some agreement or some discrepancy about what's represented there.
Amy, I'm wondering about, you know, whenever anyone writes any kind of biography, especially what this is, an autobiography, there certainly has to be an attendance to the facts. Are there things in here that you could say this is factually untrue, or are you simply left with something where, well, okay, she's got the bare facts right, but she has spun them in her direction in virtually every case?
Well, the book is fairly generalized. There's very few dates. There's very few specific details. You have a lot of discussion about policies and things of that kind. But I don't think that the book indulges in the kind of very, very specific factual detail that you could jump on. But I also think that there is a certain level of exhaustion in the American public concerning the Clintons and their version of historical truth. And there's a lot of commentaries that have been written about the book that really just show sort of a weariness. It's filled with lies. We're not surprised. And we don't want to take the time to underline them all. And one review came right out and said that. We're fairly confident Hillary wrote this herself because it's so laden down with lies. For example, one thing that she throws out is she tries to pin responsibility for Vincent Foster's suicide on the Wall Street Journal editorial board, that Vincent Foster was so despondent over the evil editorials that had been written about the Clinton administration and their neglect of the law and procedure that, you know, this contributed to a clinical depression that sent him over the edge. That is a fairly bold statement.
Amy, finally, what someone goes out and buys it and they're merely curious, what will a person have to do if they read this book in earnest to not have the give me a break reaction?
What will they have to do in earnest?
Well, what will they have to do if they read this to not have that, you know, come on, give me a break reaction?
I think that what they would have to do is they would have to approach the text with a lot of sympathy for the author, that they would have to indulge her right to record things that will be useful to her in the future politically. And they would have to be sympathetic to that ambition, I think, to be able to get through the book without a fair measure of contempt.
You're a political speechwriter. You know how language can be used to the advantage of any candidate or any personage in office. Is this autobiography as much a political speech as it is a record of living history?
I think it reads very much as a political speech. I think it is a statement of political ambition, a statement of political purpose. And the comments that are made, everything I think from her marriage to the people and the friends in her life, is really politically motivated. I think Hillary Rodham Clinton's entire life has been politically motivated, for good or for bad. But I think she would describe it as being for good.
Amy White, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Todd.
Amy White is a corporate and political speechwriter. She's author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled, With Hillary Rodham Clinton, Everything is Relative. If you can't catch it in the paper, you can read it online at stltoday.com. STL Today, the column With Hillary Rodham Clinton, Everything's Relative by Amy White. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have a two-hour discussion on the Trinity with Dr. Ken Cherb of Moberly, Missouri. It's going to be a very good conversation. I encourage you to tune in. And then Sunday night on the program, we'll be talking about repentance with the man who will follow here in the microphone in a mere 5 minutes, Pastor Tom Baker, host of Law and Gospel. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. A conversation on repentance with Pastor Tom Baker. Now, next week, we'll be broadcasting from the Schwann Center in Trago, Wisconsin, from that Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar with Craig Parton, Angus Manoj, and Rolf Preuss, and George Mather. We'll have them all in next week for you on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.